The uses of nuclear weapons in war are still, and we hope for a lot longer, stuck at 2. The United States bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945 remain the only pair of atomic bombings ever. And just imagine if Nazi Germany had gone first. It was less imagination than pending possibility in the late 30s and early 40s, and the United States and its allies put a lot of work into thwarting the Nazi nuclear ambitions. Sam Keen tells the story in The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. Sam Keen achieves the Jefferson Exchange Grand Slam with this appearance. It is his fourth, following three interviews on previous books. His last live visit came in July of 2017 for a book about the air around us, Caesar's Last Breath. Sam Keen, always a pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Hi, great to be back.
I got confused before I got to the table of contents and when I saw the copyright disclaimer that says the characters and events are fictitious.
Are fictitious?
Yes.
In this book?
Yes.
Oh, well, that must be a mistake then. They are all, this is a completely true story.
Okay. Well, I guess that's the whole point. You get things through NetGalley. I don't have a print copy with me at this point, but okay, good. So this is a book about physics, which you point out you have not done before, but it also represents a departure in some other ways. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so in my previous books, there would be sort of a central topic like the human brain, the human genome, something like that. And from that, I spun a bunch of stories, you know, stories about scientific heroes, villains, all sorts of different things. But in those cases, the chapters were a bit independent. It was like a series of interrelated short stories. Whereas this book, The Bastard Brigade, is really more like one big overarching novel where you have one big problem at the center of it, which is how to prevent Nazi Germany from getting an atomic bomb. So it is a bit of a departure for me, but it was fun to write. It was really fun to dive into the characters, do all this research, unpublished letters, things like that, and really look at what was driving American scientists to try to stop the Nazi atomic bomb project.
So give us the wide view first, Sam. How close did the Nazis come to a nuclear weapon?
Well, historians have debated that a lot, you know, talked about why they didn't get one, whether it was, you know, economic problems, whether, you know, other things were going on there. But the book really does dive into some of the details, what they were facing, what was going on. And I think one of the more interesting things is that it was really that fear of Nazi Germany that was driving the Manhattan Project scientists so much. And a lot of people don't remember it, but building an atomic bomb was a really big gamble. It was very expensive, took a lot of resources, and we probably would not have finished an atomic bomb during the war if we'd not been so terrified that Germany was going to get one first. So in fact, given that risk and expense, we might never have built an atomic bomb after the war either. So we might not have atomic weapons today.
Wow, that's quite a thought. So so we had essentially two efforts here. One was to build our own bomb, and the other one was the work to stop Germany from getting its bomb. How dangerous was that work?
Yeah, so basically it involved sabotage work. It involved spying on them. In some cases, it even involved trying to assassinate members of the Nazi atomic bomb project. So plenty of people died on these missions, and other people were under the line of fire, you know, getting shot at, getting maimed, crippled, things like that. So a lot of people sacrificed their lives in order to stop this.
So let's get some names in here and talk about some personal motivations. Who, for example, was Samuel Goudschmidt, and why did he join the effort to deny Nazi Germany a bomb?
So Goudschmidt was a physicist, been born in the Netherlands, eventually moved to the United States to work here. And he was a good friend of Werner Heisenberg, very famous German scientist who was actually working on the Nazi atomic bomb project, what they called their Uranium Club. So Goudschmidt, because he knew Heisenberg and because he was a scientist himself, was sort of involved in ferreting out information, trying to figure out what Heisenberg and the other Nazis were up to. But in addition to this, Goudschmidt was Jewish. And his parents had been swept into a concentration camp in Europe. So while he was over in Europe trying to find out information about the Nazi atomic bomb, he was also trying to hunt down and try to save his parents at the same time. So he had kind of these dual missions going on while he was over there.
Talk about the level of sophistication that the Nazis had gotten to with their rocketry, for example, because we had the V1 attacks on England and the V2 followed that. How far did they get with those projects?
Yeah, and it wasn't just the rockets, too. So the Nazis really did have the inside track on the atomic bomb. Uranium fission had been discovered in Germany in the first place. Again, they had very smart scientists like Werner Heisenberg working for their uranium club. They had the best industry in the world. And as you said, they had rockets, V1s, V2s, and things that could potentially deliver the bombs and bomb London, things like that. In fact, one of the characters in the book, Joe Kennedy, died, older brother of JFK, the president, died on a mission when they were afraid that they had atomic missile bunkers, that they were going to start sending missiles over to London. And Joe died on one of those missions.
So was it ever called the Bastard Brigade officially, or is this just a good title for a book?
Well, it is a good title for a book, I hope. They did call them the Bastard Brigade, and when I say them, I mean the kind of the spies and the military commandos that they sent undercover into Europe to try to spy on, sabotage, and assassinate. They called that group the Bastard Brigade, the Bastard Unit, partly because they were not part of the normal military chain of command. So they didn't have a parent unit. So it was kind of metaphorical to call them a bastard unit because, again, they weren't part of the chain of command. But they were also kind of rough and tumble, kind of salty. They were always getting threatened with court martials for running behind enemy lines, doing things they shouldn't have done. So they kind of relished, I think, being called bastards as well. So it was kind of a dual name for them.
Well, they certainly took some personal and professional risks, and it looks like humankind turned out the better for some of that. The book is called The Bastard Brigade, The True Story of the Plot to Stop the Nazi Atomic Bomb. It's written by Sam Keen. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about his latest work. You can join the conversation by phone or email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Sam Keen is back with us, the science writer who's written so many books about so many interesting subjects, including The Disappearing Spoon and The Violinist's Thumb, Caesar's Last Breath, and now he's with us to talk about science, but in relation to some fairly heavy history as well. The Nazi effort to build a nuclear weapon in World War II was thwarted by the Allies, and the people who did the thwarting are profiled in a book called The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. You can join the conversation on the exchange, swap some stories, ask some questions, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's meet some of the other people who were part of this this bastard unit. Mo Berg actually achieved some fame in another field first. Which one was that?
Yeah, so Mo Berg was a professional baseball player for a very long time. Played on the Red Sox, the White Sox, the Washington Senators. To be frank, he wasn't the best ball player in the world, pretty mediocre, spent most of his career as a backup catcher. But he was a brilliant, brilliant scholar. He entered Princeton when he was 16 years old, studied at Sorbonne, Columbia later. He also spoke something like a dozen different languages, and became actually a bona fide national celebrity. He went on a radio quiz show in the late 1930s, kind of the Jeopardy of its day, and he blew everyone away with all of the knowledge he had, the information he had. And after that, he became friends with the Marx Brothers, Will Rogers, Albert Einstein, President Franklin Roosevelt. So Berg was really, despite not being that great of a ball player, was really kind of a national celebrity and one of the most famous baseball players in the world at the time, in the 1920s, 1930s. So he eventually, when the war started, retired from baseball and joined what was called the Office of Strategic Services, which was basically the precursor to the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. And OSS, that agency, decided to train Berg as an assassin, and they sent him undercover into Europe to try to assassinate that scientist I mentioned before, the German physicist Werner Heisenberg, when Heisenberg was giving a lecture in Switzerland in 1944. So that's how this famous baseball player kind of fits into this whole plot. And it's really, when you think about it, kind of an insane idea to send a very famous athlete in to try to murder a Nobel Prize winner. I mean, imagine sending, like, you know, Bryce Harper or LeBron James in to try to kill a Nobel Prize winner nowadays. That's about the level that this plot was. But again, that fear of Adolf Hitler getting an atomic weapon was so strong and was so powerful that they were willing to consider anything to try to stop that, even kind of crazy ideas like this.
Yeah, desperate times producing desperate measures is certainly ringing true here. Yeah,
Mo Definitely.
Berg is just an amazing story. There's a lot of sub-stories in here that we could probably make a whole book about him on. We do get a Curie in this story, but it's not Marie. Tell us about her daughter.
Yeah, it's actually her daughter, Irene Joliot Curie. And she's been kind of lost to history, unfortunately. I think it's kind of sad that Irene doesn't get as much credit as she deserves. I guess maybe a little overshadowed by her mother, Marie. But Irene also won a Nobel Prize in her own right. Very good, very famous scientist. And she's really involved in the book because her research, along with the research of her husband, Frederick Joliot, their research was very important in the 1930s as scientists were trying to figure out uranium fission, chain reactions, things like that. So they basically laid the scientific groundwork for atomic bombs. And at the beginning of the book, I kind of walk through some of the science involved, how they discovered uranium fission in the first place. And it's kind of interesting because you see this slow dawning realization among these scientists about what actually was going on. A lot of them got into the work in the first place just because they were curious. There was this thing called radioactivity. They wanted to know more about it. And then slowly, bit by bit, year by year, they realized how dangerous this actually was and the fact that if you harnessed radioactivity in the right way, you could make a chain reaction. And with the chain reaction, you could build an atomic bomb. So it's kind of fun to be in the laboratory working with them. But at the same time, a lot of them kind of had this blind spot about wanting to push forward, even though this was very dangerous work. It's like they almost didn't realize the implications in some cases of what they were doing.
Sam Keen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. And the story is well told in this section of the book. The idea that of being in the scientist's lab and having them ask questions that they didn't really get the answers to completely for, it unfolded over a long period of time. The idea that they were trying to figure out, well, why did this happen and not that? And so ultimately, after a lot of fits and starts, Irene and her husband, Frederick Joliot, did win, as you pointed out, a Nobel Prize. And Joliot made a bit of a prediction in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech about what?
Yeah, so at the end of his acceptance speech, he predicted that there could be something out there called a chain reaction. And it was a term no one had ever really heard in this context before of talking about atomic fission, uranium, but that, again, if you harnessed it the right way, that you could actually build a gigantic bomb, a very powerful bomb, the most powerful bombs ever, if you harnessed a chain reaction. And I think it's kind of interesting that right after Joliot gave that speech where he mentioned chain reactions and the potential for releasing a lot of energy, harnessing them into a bomb, basically, there was also a German scientist, a biologist, who won the Nobel Prize that year in a different field. He got up at that same ceremony, turned to the audience, and threw his hand up in the air in kind of this weird salute. He threw his arm out. He had his palm extended. And people realized that what he was doing was he was giving the Nazi salute, the Sieg Heil salute, at the Nobel Prize ceremony. So already at this point, this was in 1935 or so, already at this point you had atomic fission chain reactions and Nazi politics colliding. And unfortunately, over the next few years, they started to collide even more.
Well, it's quite a race then to try to make sure that you can curtail the moves of the Nazi Empire as it formed, and try to make sure that they don't get the knowledge of how to work a seriously dangerous bomb. Enrico Fermi's mentioned in the book. He added to the work of the Joliot Curies. Who actually figured out fission as we know it?
Well, it was a couple of different scientists kind of piecing together different things, but the few who end up getting the most credit for it are a pair named Otto Hahn, who was German, working in Berlin, and then Lisa Meitner, who was an Austrian physicist who was also working in Berlin. And it's a bit convoluted in that Hahn did some of the experimental work and kind of provided the evidence for uranium fission. So basically the idea of splitting an atom, of breaking it in half, that's what uranium fission is. Hahn provided the experimental evidence for that, but Meitner was the one who really figured out what was going on. She understood the interpretation of it and basically how dangerous it was. And it was interesting because Meitner had actually been run out of Nazi Germany for being Jewish not long before this. So she was actually in exile at this point when Hahn figured this out, and Hahn had to write her a letter explaining his results. So she was in Sweden at the time and had to figure this out kind of remotely. So as I mentioned in the book, it's kind of interesting that there were kind of two women at the center of this research trying to figure out atomic fission at a time when there really weren't very many female scientists in the world. You had Irene Joliot-Curie and Lisa Meitner both at the center of this work. So I think that's really kind of a fascinating tidbit, kind of a side note to this whole atomic effort to stop the Nazis from getting the atomic bomb.
Truly. Now, you mentioned that Otto Hahn published the work about fission, and boy, what timing. How soon after his article published did war start?
Yeah, so he actually published that in December of 1938, and then war started less than a year later. And Hahn actually published this information about uranium fission explicitly to warn the Allies about it. He knew that if war started too quickly and he hadn't published this information, that the Allies might not know about it. Nazi Germany might clamp down on all information getting out, and then Nazi Germany would have a monopoly on this startling breakthrough when the war started. And Hahn did not want that to happen. So he actually called a publisher friend of his who was trying to finish up the latest issue, and the publisher friend actually pulled an article that was already typeset, already ready to go, and swapped Hahn's in to make sure that the information got out as soon as possible. So if Hahn had not done that, pushed so fast, the information might have been clamped down and might never have gotten out before the war started.
We were talking to Sam Keen on the Jefferson Exchange about his latest book. It's called The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. As usual, as with any Sam Keen book, there's lots of great little stories in here, but also some fairly solid science as well. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions, comments, welcome by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I apparently spoke too late about the idea that Mo Berg could be the subject of a story all his own. Paul Rudd starred in a movie about him last year called The Catcher Was a Spy. I don't know if Paul Rudd's the best choice to play Mo Berg, but what the heck?
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie, but yeah, he has been kind of along a subject of fascination because, you know, he was such a big celebrity, and then he, again, got dragged into this crazy assassination plot trying to take out one of these German scientists. So he really did lead a very colorful, very interesting life.
Thanks to Larry and Eugene for pointing out the existence of the movie. Let's come back to the idea of the Nazis and the science. I mean, it seems like if the science was as new as it was, it's not necessarily the kind of thing that political figures would be that in tune with. I mean, so were there people in the Third Reich who were savvy enough to figure out that this is something that they could, if they could develop it further, could be a tremendously powerful weapon?
Well, it was more on the kind of the military people were kind of involved in it. So they had some military physicists in what they called their Uranium Club, which was basically their Manhattan Project. But you see that actually on both sides of the Atlantic, where political leaders in some cases just didn't quite grasp what atomic fission was and why it could be so powerful. In the United States, even, Albert Einstein famously wrote Franklin Delano Roosevelt a letter saying, hey, there's this thing discovered, you know, uranium fission. We really need to jump on this and try to do it, because if we don't, the Nazis are going to. And the letter took like 2 months to get to FDR. And then after that delay, FDR wrote something on there like, this needs action. But then no one did anything. And in fact, it took 2 full years after that for our Manhattan Project to get founded. So, you know, political leaders did have somewhat of an excuse. They were actually dealing with the war as it was going on. But there was kind of this blind spot about not realizing and not understanding how important atomic fission was going to be. And you really see that, again, on both sides of the Atlantic, where political leaders didn't quite grasp what a big deal this was.
We've already talked a bit about Werner Heisenberg and how instrumental he was to the German success. And unlike a lot of other scientists, he didn't jump ship and try to get out of the country. What was his reasoning for staying in Germany? He did have his issues with the Nazis, but he decided to stick with them instead of work against them.
Yeah, so the basic reason was Heisenberg was a huge patriot. He loved Germany. And even though he had some run-ins with the Nazis, he still thought, basically, you know, Germany, right or wrong. And he wanted them to win the war. He did not want them to lose the war. And he decided, as he said, Germany needs me, that I need to be in Germany, and I want to do everything I can to help Germany out. And this attitude really caused a lot of pain and heartache among his friends. And in fact, he lost a lot of friends during the war because of his actions, because of the fact that he was working on atomic fission research for the Nazi regime. So there's a lot of bitter feelings, and he lost a lot of friends over his decision to stay in Germany and work with them.
I mentioned that, like any Sam Keen book, there's a fair discussion of the actual science involved here, and you actually make it easier. There's some cartoony kinds of pictures in here that really do make it clear what goes on in splitting atoms. You think you can have a short radio description of uranium enrichment?
It's probably the chain reaction, actually. What happens was you have, you know, a single uranium atom or a few of them. You split it, so basically a neutron comes in, subatomic particle, hits the uranium atom, it splits, and then that uranium atom releases a few more neutrons. So these neutrons fly off, they hit other uranium atoms, and each of those uranium atoms splits and releases energy. And then each of those atoms that splits release a few more neutrons, which fly off, hit other uranium atoms, split even more of them. So basically, it's a chain reaction. You have one uranium atom splitting, then you have two or three, then each of those causes two or three more to split. And then at each step, you have more and more and more energy being released. So as you mentioned in the book, there's kind of a diagram that walks you through this, really explains in a basic way what's going on and helps you understand what a chain reaction is and why a chain reaction would lead to an atomic bomb.
And the physicists at that time, I mean, as they finally wrapped their mind around it, realized that this is a tremendous amount of energy that can be released.
Yeah, I mean, it was by far the biggest bomb that had ever been produced when they had the Trinity test in New Mexico and then the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And it was actually the reason driving a lot of this fear of the Allies, too, because, you know, right away, we had a foothold in France and Germany. We knew that we could take Hitler down if we just only had the time. But they knew also that with just a few pounds of uranium, just enough uranium you could even hold it in your hand, that Hitler could reverse the entire D-Day operation and drive the Allies off the continent forever. So again, that fear was really driving them on all these crazy missions that go on during the book.
Which lead to places like a heavy water plant in Norway. What is heavy water and why was it made at that one place in Norway?
So heavy water is basically an alternative form of water that you use in studying atomic reactions, chain reactions. You can use it to help build an atomic reactor, basically things like that. So it helps you out with the preliminary steps, the research that eventually leads to an atomic bomb. Heavy water is very expensive to make, very expensive to produce. You need a lot of water and a lot of electricity. And there was really only one place in the world that was producing it. It was a plant in Norway. And Nazi Germany, unfortunately, had taken over this heavy water plant when they invaded Norway and conquered Norway early on in the war. So the Allies decided they couldn't let this stand. And they eventually started sending in commandos, basically, undercover military commandos, to try to wipe out this plant. You know, you mentioned movies before. There was actually a Kirk Douglas movie made about taking out that plant in Norway. But the real story of what happened is even wilder and crazier, I think. It's really, really a very impressive mission that they went on to try to take out this heavy water plant in Norway.
As described by you, it involves skis and rabbit fur underwear and 600-foot climbs up sheer walls.
Yeah, it's a really wild story. It's amazing to think the mission that eventually succeeded, they basically sent nine commandos in to take on this entire plant. They had guards all over the place, machine guns. They had to break in. They had to climb up and down a gorge, 600-foot gorge, to even get at the plant. And yet they got in and out and blew up this heavy water equipment without firing a shot. It was really one of the most amazing, brave missions of the entire war. So it really is an incredible story in the book.
Just one episode of many in the book by Sam Keen called The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. We'll talk more with Sam Keen. And if you would like to join our conversation, you're welcome to ask some questions and share some stories as well by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Keen, Bastard Brigade, and you in a minute 20. Our guest is Sam Keen, the science writer, joining us for a fourth time to talk about his latest book. This one is called The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. So a bit of history mixed in with the science here, as is the case in a lot of Sam Keen books. But we're talking about the people who worked hard to make sure that the first atomic bomb in the world was not used and deployed by Nazi Germany. Questions, comments, welcome on the Jefferson Exchange as usual. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We had talked a bit about the Uranium Club and how much of a jump start it got on its ally equivalent, the Manhattan Project, in the United States. How much of a jump start, and where did the Uranium Club do its work?
So the Uranium Club basically got founded 2 full years before our Manhattan Project. Got founded in late September 1939. So even before a month had elapsed of World War II, the Nazis were already focused on harnessing the power of atomic fission. And they did their research in some different places during the war, depending kind of on what scientists you're talking about. Some of the research took place right outside Berlin. Some was in Leipzig. Eventually, toward the end of the war, they moved to southern Germany to get out of the way of U.S. bombing raids. So it was kind of taking place in different parts around Germany.
And so, wow, they got quite a jump then on the American folks doing this. As you look at the overall picture, Sam, does it appear that the sabotage and the disruption worked, or were the German scientists having some of their own struggles in general, either with the theory or with the materials to put their own bomb together?
It was kind of a combination of both. Our efforts did slow them down, prevented them from doing certain things, and really disrupted them in a lot of ways. Germany was also kind of under these strict wartime rationing and economic conditions where they just couldn't throw as much material and money at it as the Allies could, especially the United States. But the thing was, the Americans had no idea that this was happening because we didn't have anyone on the inside telling us information. And that's really where the book comes from, is, again, we had this driving fear that we just didn't know what the Nazis were up to. So the book really focuses on why the Americans were so scared and why they started pulling all these crazy missions, because they really didn't know what Nazi Germany was up to.
I noticed that a lot of people write books about World War II at this moment in history have the benefit of some declassified documents. Is there anything like that in your research for this book?
Yeah, most of the book came from, going to archives, in hunting around libraries, publishing, unpublished letters, memoirs that never got published, things like that. So, yeah, there was a lot of research going in and just looking at unpublished material and declassified documents and kind of trying to piece together all of these different threads of the story and all the different characters involved.
Was there one particular person or one particular side of the story that got you interested in pursuing this as far as making a whole book out of it?
Well, the Moberg story about the professional baseball player, that definitely captured my attention, kind of a fun, interesting story. Another aspect of the story that I really did enjoy was the fact that one of the Kennedy brothers appeared in there. I think a lot of people know that Joseph Kennedy died during the war, JFK's older brother, but a lot of them don't realize it was actually on this kind of a peripheral branch of this mission to try to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. And so, I didn't know that. And it was really fun to kind of try to dive in and unravel this story and figure out why Joseph volunteered for this, crazy mission that he was on and how it ended up not only unraveling on him and resulting in his death, but really changed the political fortunes of the Kennedy family afterward. Because Joe had been the one that was groomed to run for the presidency someday. He was always considered the big star of the family. And when he died on this mission, it was only then that JFK really rose and became the focus of the family's political ambitions.
Talk about Joe Kennedy Jr. a bit. I get the sense that he was kind of a reckless, devil-may-care kind of guy.
Yeah, he was. He and JFK were born less than 2 years apart, and they really had a big kind of sibling rivalry. They were in competition over sports and grades, their future political careers, and everything, really. And Joe joined the Navy in large part to become a war hero and to get a leg up on getting elected to political office later. The only problem with that plan was that Jack joined the Navy as well, and Jack ended up becoming an even bigger war hero. The famous PT-109 mission, he became a national celebrity. There were magazine stories about him, newspaper articles all over. And Joe really got sort of ragingly jealous that his kid brother was outshining him. So what he started doing was volunteering for all these dangerous and reckless missions to try to out-macho his younger brother and to try to turn the spotlight back on himself so that he could become the family star again. And that's what really drove Joe to this kind of reckless mission. So basically, the idea of this mission was there were these concrete bunkers, these giant concrete bunkers in northern France that the Americans were hearing rumors were going to start launching atomic missiles over in London, which would obviously be a disaster, atomic missiles coming into London. So they decided they were going to take out these concrete bunkers. And they were so big and so well reinforced that the only way they decided they could take these concrete bunkers out was to take a giant plane, to strip out everything inside, and to fill these planes back up with napalm or another explosive, something like 21,000 pounds of explosives. Then they were going to fly these planes over to France with remote control. So basically they were drone airplanes. And then they were going to smash these explosive-packed planes into the concrete bunkers and wipe them out. The only problem with that plan was that even though we had some remote control that could fly the planes into the bunkers, we didn't have the technology to get the planes off the ground. We still needed a human pilot to take off with the planes. And so Joe volunteered to be one of those human pilots to get all these explosives off the ground. And then he had to bail out before they actually hit home and exploded in the bunker. So that's the mission that Joe was on. And he did it in large part due to jealousy for his younger brother.
Wow. A momentary aside on their father, Joe Kennedy Sr. What did he think about the rise of fascism in Europe as it happened? He was an American ambassador to London, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it was kind of an interesting side note, something that I didn't really know about. But Joe Kennedy was actually kind of on the appeasement camp and got smeared as a defeatist because his basic idea was Hitler's too powerful, we should just give him whatever he wants and just kind of get out of his way. So FDR actually was furious with Joseph Kennedy Sr., the ambassador, and basically fired him early on in the war because he was so mad about all the reckless things Joseph Kennedy was saying. And the Kennedy family actually kind of had this stink on them, this stink of appeasement and defeatism. And it was really only JFK's heroism and Joseph dying that really rehabilitated the family name. So the son sacrifices ended up kind of rehabilitating what the father had done.
Wow. Let us take a phone call. Here's Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Keene. His book is The Bastard Brigade.
Hi. Yes, I saw the movie The Catcher Was a Spy with Paul Rudd last year. Mm-hmm. I had to get it from the library and was surprised it never came out in the theaters, at least not in the Eugene area. I spoke to a friend of mine who lives and works in the Hollywood area, and he said that was because Mo Green was really gay, and the production company and the studio got some flack about portraying an American hero as gay, so they changed the plot and made him bisexual, or hinted at his bisexuality in the movie. Is that true?
Well,
there have been rumors about that, that Mo Bird might have been gay, might not have been, but really there's no hard evidence for it. He was a bachelor his whole life, but he did have some confirmed love affairs with women, too. So it's really up in the air, and there's no hard proof one way or the other on that. But an interesting side note to his life.
I noticed, too, that the film was rated NC-17, which is going to keep it out of a fair number of theaters as well. So I'm not sure what the content was that got it there, but that's another thing. Thanks for the call on that one, Vince. Let's talk about another character in the book, in The Bastard Brigade, Boris Pasch. I mean, there's another book in his story alone. What was his role with the Manhattan Project?
So he was kind of head of security for the Manhattan Project at the beginning. But eventually, when we realized that we needed to send in a spot and get more information about what the Nazis were doing, he started to head up what was called the Alsace mission, which was the mission that really went into Europe and tried to ferret out secrets about the Nazi Uranium Club. And that's actually the group that the book is named after, the Bastard Brigade of the title. So they were kind of running around in Europe trying to figure out what was going on, and Pasch was the head of that mission.
Okay, and so what was his concern with Robert Oppenheimer, the guy running the Manhattan Project?
Well, so Pasch actually, he was born in the United States, but he grew up mostly in Russia. He fought for the Russians in World War I. He joined the army when he was just 14 years old. And then he joined the Russian Revolution, which kind of broke out in the middle of World War I over in Russia. So he joined that war when he was just 17. So he was a two-war veteran by the time he was just 17 years old. And he ended up fighting on the anti-communist side, which, of course, lost the Russian Revolution, had to flee to the United States. And when he came over here, he actually became a teacher, ended up at Hollywood High School, where Judy Garland, Lana Turner, Mickey Rooney were all students there. Kind of an interesting side note. But because he'd lost that war in Russia, Pasch was a very fierce anti-communist. And Robert Oppenheimer, head of the Manhattan Project, had friends who were fellow travelers who were communists. And so Pasch was quite worried that Oppenheimer was, you know, talking to Russians, talking to spies, things like that. So those two ended up butting heads over Oppenheimer's past and whether or not he was a security risk.
So the Nazis on their side of the Atlantic certainly were aware of efforts to impact their operation. Did they make some great changes? You mentioned they moved the Uranium Club around. Did they make other changes to their security procedures to try to protect their nuclear work?
They did. They, as you said, they moved the Uranium Club south. And I mentioned the sabotage to the heavy water plants before as well. They actually moved production of that into Germany, into the Reich as well, to make sure that the Allies couldn't attack and bomb that again. So they were trying to move things basically beyond the reach of where we could bomb or sabotage or get at them. Yeah.
So with the characters we follow through the book, I mean, it seems like a lot of disparate stuff going on in different parts of the world. Did any of them ever actually work together?
Some of them did. So Mo Berg and Boris Pasch, we talked about, they actually had some run-ins with each other. Mo Berg and Samuel Goudschmidt, who we mentioned at the top of the hour, they actually hooked up on one mission, and Goudschmidt was one of the people who briefed Berg when he went in and tried to assassinate one of the German scientists, when he tried to assassinate Werner Heisenberg. So yeah, there were different branches of these missions, but they were all coming together because they were, again, all focused on just keeping the bomb out of Adolf Hitler's hands. So they did work together in some cases, yeah.
Sam, was there a particular point at which the Allies felt like they could relax because the Nazi effort did appear to be coming apart, if not the entire Third Reich itself?
Yeah, I mean, toward the end of the war, we knew that we did, obviously have the upper hand and that we were probably going to conquer them. But even toward the very last days of the war, the head of the Manhattan Project, Leslie Groves, was really worried that the Nazis were going to spring some surprise on us. Even as late as April and May of 1945, you had rumors appearing in Nazi newspapers about supposed atomic bombs coming, about dirty radioactive bombs that we were going to release on the Americans. So even toward the very end of the war, we really didn't quite know where exactly things stood, and we kept pushing for that reason.
A couple seconds left. I have to ask, are there any parallels in today's world, people who you don't think should have nukes?
Well, it'd be better if everyone did not have nukes, but given that the world does, I mean, you still see some of this spy stuff going on today. We have people, you know, assassinating nuclear scientists in other countries, wiping them out, trying to kill them. So this fear still really drives a lot of people today, and you still see some of these assassinations and other things going on in the modern world. So we're still dealing with a lot of these problems.
And from 75, 80 years ago, it's still an impactful story. It's called The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the plot to stop the Nazi atomic bomb. It is the work of Sam Keen, who again has the Jefferson Exchange Grand Slam with his fourth appearance. Sam, always good to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.